Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is novelist, essayist, and critic Thomas Mallon. Mallon is the author of 10 novels and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times Book Review. Many of his novels marry fiction with historical events, both recent and from the past, and that's certainly the case for his latest novel, which finishes a set of contemporary presidential novels, the first being Watergate, set during the Nixon administration, the second, Finale, set during Reagan's presidency, and his finale, Landfall, the new book, which is set in 2005 during George W. Bush's administration, the year of the Iraqi insurgency and Hurricane Katrina. Landfall follows two fictional staffers who first met during Bush's first run for elective office, a congressional seat in West Texas back in 1978. Ross Weatherall, or Weatherman, as the president calls him, is a political appointee and a true believer in the Bush presidency, a staffer at the Endowment for the Humanities. Allison O'Connor, on the other hand, is a security specialist and Bush skeptic who finds herself thrust into the Bush's National Security Council. The two rekindle an old relationship that Bush himself encourages. Perhaps if he can't fix Iraq or New Orleans, he can fix these two. With a real cast of over 100 characters, it's a Washingtonian's view of Washington by the former Vassar and George Washington University professor. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books in a Book Smart Tulsa event. And Thomas Mallon joins us to talk about Landfall today on Studio Tulsa. Thomas Mallon, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Landfall is the third of a trilogy of books you've written on presidents in Washington. You call it your fictional Washington trilogy. Began with Watergate a few years back. Finale was the second, and now Landfall. And of course, this is the freshest of those books. It's only been a little over 10 years from those events. Why was now the right time to write it?
Well, I'm not sure. I didn't plan this as a trilogy. You know, it sort of just accrued, and my editor began to think of it as a trilogy before I did. But what you're saying is true. This is so close to the present day that it can scarcely be called historical fiction, which is the label that, you know, my books usually get, because most of them are set a good deal further back in the past than this one is. So that did make it very different for me, writing it. And yet, I think the fact that the last few years have been so convulsive, and there's this sense that so many political norms have, you know, gone out the window, and that we are in really uncharted territory since January of 2017, I think in a way that makes the Bush era of the mid-noughts seem more distant from us than it really is. I think there were, you know, there's Trump, and then there are the 44 presidents, or 43, I guess, since Grover Cleveland was in there twice, who preceded him, you know, and I think people seem ready for a look back, maybe. I hope they're ready for a look back at the Bush years as something that, you know, can now be seen with some kind of perspective. This is, of course, fiction, so I'm not offering it as a, you know, historical reinterpretation or reappraisal, but it's in its own way some kind of consideration of those years.
When you look back to those years, you know, the polarization that we feel today was just as evident. I mean, we thought it was just like today. You know, polarization has never been greater. It was the same thing in 2005 at the time of the events of that you write about in Landfall.
Yes. I mean, I think that the personal animus toward George Bush in the country was enormous. I wrote a little bit recently for the New Yorker's website about his father when his father died early in December. And I said that George H.W. Bush was probably the last president not to have been despised by a significant portion of the population. I think that we've been in the grip of this for about 25 years now. There were always Clinton haters, people who didn't like Bill Clinton for one reason or another, who were ferocious against him and really, you know, descended upon him in his second term with a kind of aggression that was odd given what was actually at issue. There were certainly Obama haters. God knows there are Trump haters, and Trump partisans hate the other side with special vigor. Bush Sr., I've actually skipped over George W. Bush, there were tremendous personal disgust and hatred toward him after the Florida recount, after the Iraq invasion, after Katrina. So we've had this phenomenon of about 25 years of these incumbents, these four presidents who have excited these very strong passions in the electorate. And I think that was one very big difference between the younger George Bush and the older George Bush. When the older Bush passed away, you know, there was a general outpouring of affection toward him. I think that's kind of gone from our politics.
Yeah. You know, there's still a faction out there still talking about Clintons every day.
Yeah. Well, I think that one thing that has happened in the culture now, too, is with the advent of Facebook and especially Twitter, everybody can get into the game immediately. Everybody has their own printing press, their own megaphone right now. And there are so many people competing to be heard on so many topics, especially political ones, that in order to draw attention, you have to pump up the volume so much that the discourse becomes shriller and shriller and shriller just because of the efforts people expend to get noticed. And that, too, I think has coarsened the discourse to a great extent. I mean, I was never a great fan of Sarah Palin. And when she ran for vice president in 2008, she was probably the first American politician to make serious use of Facebook and very shrewd use of Facebook. You know, she figured, well, the media wasn't friendly to her. She was just going to talk over their heads. She was going to talk directly to millions of people who could follow her on Facebook. And so she would make these postings, and people would sort of, who didn't like her, would mock them at the time that, you know, she had a kind of tangled up syntax and so forth. And I said, you know, a couple of years ago when Twitter had burst on the scene, I said, you know, if you look at, take another look at Sarah Palin's Facebook postings from, you know, the late 2000s, I mean, they look like a lost volume of the Federalist Papers, you know, compared to these crazy one sentence. It's to me, it's more like graffiti than writing. And I don't think it's done our politics a lot of good.
Now, I have to ask you about your portrayal of George W. Bush, because it seems fairly affectionate, I think. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, a lot of his critics said he was not the smartest president that ever occupied the Oval Office. Your portrayal seems to be that he's smarter than he let on, and that he reveled in making people think he was not as smart as he was.
You know, he developed, as a little boy, a penchant for comic entertainment. When he was about 7 years old, his sister, Robin, died of leukemia. And for large stretches of time before the rest of his siblings came along, he was alone in this little house in Midland with his mother. His father was traveling a lot, trying to get the business going and so forth. And Barbara Bush was extremely depressed after the loss of her child. And Bush would cheer her up by becoming a cut-up, becoming a scamp. And he was the mischievous boy. I mean, Jeb was the one, the younger brother, eventually, who became the one in which the family's political hopes and ambitions resided. Whereas George W. was, I think, in many ways, much more the apple of his mother's eye. She clung to him. I mean, there's a famous story in his biographies about how somebody comes to knock on his door, a friend asking him if he wants to go out and play some baseball, which was Bush's lifelong athletic passion, baseball. And he said, no, I have to stay here with my mom. Basically, he had to, you know, entertain her a little. So some of that was there. I mean, the idea that, you know, that this fellow went to Yale and then went to Harvard for an MBA, even if he was a C student at Yale or whatever he was, the idea that he didn't have anything on the ball intellectually, I think, is just kind of silly. And I do think that he, and we're learning this now more and more, I do think he ran his own shop. The idea that Dick Cheney ran the administration is just really kind of silly, I think. He knew what he wanted to do. He could be very short with people. One of the things the book tries to show is the sense I have of him as somebody who's different sides, the good old boy, the self-mocking person that you're talking about, alternated with the short-tempered, impatient, petulant Bush. I mean, you could see this if you watched him in a press conference, the speed with which his moods alternated. And I've heard this from people who have worked with him. And that was one of the things that I was trying to capture. One of the things, though, I would say is he did definitely have a sense of humor about himself. And I find this chillingly absent in the present occupant of the White House. I've never seen the president laugh, let alone laugh at himself. Bush definitely could laugh at himself. The Bush Library, the Bush sort of alumni association, people who served in the Bush administration, every Friday they get an email about what's going on at the Bush Library and so forth. And there's a podcast about national security, a very good, serious-minded podcast. And the title of the podcast is The Strategerist. And, you know, that comes from, I think it was a Will Ferrell joke on Saturday Night Live. Bush never actually said strategery, but everybody laughed when Will Ferrell said it because Bush did mangle words. Laura Bush used to joke about how, unlike her husband, she could pronounce nuclear, for instance. And, but they, you know, they call the podcast The Strategerist. And so I do think that he, I think he was a much more complicated man than people imagine. People always talked about him in terms of his father and, you know, did he have some terrible compulsion to compete with the father, you know, to take care of Saddam Hussein in a way that the father had stopped short of doing. I think that that simplifies things way too much. For one thing, I think he was much more, and I'm not the first person to point this out, I think he was much more his mother's son than his father's. But I tried to show him as a round character and tried to get inside his head at moments. I mean, that's really what novelists do. I mean, a novel is a kind of empathy machine, and you try to get in and drive it and see where it'll take you.
What's really interesting about Landfall, though, is there's so much nonfiction in this fiction, work of fiction. Obviously, you've read most of these folks' memoirs, and so you, I assume that helped inform your character development of people like Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld. Interesting, you were talking about Dick Cheney just a moment ago, and he's a peripheral figure in this book.
He's not central because, for one thing, I feel that, you know, this notion of Cheney as the mastermind, I think, has been way overdone. I think there was, in fact, a growing distance between Bush and Cheney in the second term. I think Bush very much drove his own administration in foreign policy. And so I think for that reason, I wanted to be a little counterintuitive and not make Cheney that much of a figure. And I've been asked a lot in the last couple weeks if I've seen Vice, and I've not seen it. I think I've deliberately not seen it. My sense is that it's pretty over the top. But I figured I would just keep myself away from that while I'm out talking about this book. Yeah. But you're right, there's an enormous amount of material available. You know, they all write their own memoirs, and then there are biographies of them that are written, and then you have the enormous cache of documentation, presidential papers, and so forth, always going back to the newspaper and reading the newspaper from the time I'm writing about as if it's my current daily paper. That's always been my practice. And the other thing that is really very much a factor in this is YouTube and the C-SPAN archive. If you're writing about recent history like this, you have this enormous trove of visual and audio material available to you. And it's a bonanza for a historical novelist. I mean, there's a chapter late in the book where a lot of the cast of characters are gathered together at the funeral for Gerald Ford. Yes. In the National Cathedral early in 2007. And, you know, you can just watch the whole 2 hours of the funeral by clicking on the C-SPAN archive. And, you know, you sit there and you begin to get ideas for what people might have said to each other, what they might have been thinking at one point or another. It's a trove of things that, you know, just wasn't available until very recently.
My guest today is Thomas Mallon, a novelist and critic, and his latest book is titled Landfall, a Novel. It's primarily set in 2005 at the beginning of Bush's second term, at a time of great triumph for President George W. Bush. He's just won re-election, perhaps against odds at some point during the first 4 years, and he's got big plans going into the second term, but little does he know that the wheels are really falling off in Iraq, and of course with Hurricane Katrina, and that's the book's current events focus within the, but really you focus on two fictional characters that are sort of witnesses to everything that's going on. And actually, the book begins in 1978. Mm-hmm. And I found this is really interesting. This is a real event, the Bush Bash in Lubbock, Texas, where these two characters first meet. And why was this important in 78, other than the fact that most of these characters that we think of dominating Washington during this time got their start in 78. Dick Cheney won election in Wyoming. You know, a whole cast of people who would dominate Washington
start on the scene. And it's funny. I wanted to get these two young people to meet. They meet as teenagers in Texas, and then they have a youthful romance, and then they reconnect nearly 30 years later when they're both in Washington for one reason and another. And the funny thing about this is I lived in Lubbock in 1978. I was fresh out of graduate school, 26 years old, with a PhD in English literature, and I got a job at Texas Tech. I was there for all of 1 year. I was a visiting assistant professor, and I remember George W. Bush's, the very young George W. Bush's run for Congress. He was only 32 years old. His father hadn't even been vice president yet. And he was running as a Republican for the seat of George Mahon, who was an old New Deal stalwart, had been in Congress as a Democrat for decades. And West Texas had not turned red yet. It was about to. The Reagan Revolution was coming, and Texas politics were changing enormously. Bush lost. But he ran a good race. He ran against a very moderate Democrat named Ken Hance, who later became a Republican the way many conservative Democrats in Texas did. And I was there for this race. I was not at this event, the Bush Bash, but I do remember it figuring in the campaign. And I went back to Lubbock to research the race and see how it was written about in the local papers and in the university paper. And I found the ad for the Bush Bash. And the reason this figured in the campaign was the campaign of George W. Bush took out this ad in the student newspaper, Texas Tech, inviting people to come out to a campaign event for the candidate, and it advertised free beer. And this was a gift to Kenneth Hance because Lubbock had a very vexed relationship with alcohol. Lubbock was dry. And you could buy liquor by the drink in a bar or a restaurant. But you could not buy, you know, packaged liquor, wine. You had to go out past the city limits to what they called the Strip, and there would be all of these liquor stores with neon on this very West Texas landscape. It looked like looked like a space station on the moon when you went out to the Strip. And anyway, the Hance people made hay of this, and they sent the information. They may have sent the ad itself to a lot of the more conservative-minded preachers in the area. And it was made to appear that George W. Bush was trying to corrupt the youth of Texas by offering them free beer in exchange for campaign enthusiasm and so forth. Never mind that Kent Hance himself had an interest in a bar downtown, financial interest in a bar downtown called Fat Dogs. And there was a kind of political comedy. And there are people to this day who think it was a dirty trick, that Bush was set up. And I've talked to people who still believe that. And so it becomes a little kind of fictional plot motif in the book. And at the end of the book, the mystery of the Bush Bash is fictionally solved. He ran a good race. I don't think the Bush Bash sank him, didn't help, might have cost him a point or two. But it was a useful way to get the novel started, to give us a glimpse of the younger Bush, who's an attractive figure in that youthful episode, but you also see the potential for character problems, personality problems that might affect what happens politically.
Yeah. Your two characters, Ross Weatherall, he becomes an academic. He's working with the NEH, and Allison O'Connor is now at NSC. She's worked for the Army. She's not really a Republican. Ross is a true believer. He loves, mm-hmm. you know, at the time he felt he was in love with George W. Bush and Allison. But anyway, they meet again, and they find themselves in New Orleans as they're meeting up for a weekend, as they've rekindled their relationship, as he's working on a project in New Orleans just about the time of Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, and Allison O'Connor, she is an Army lawyer, and she's put onto the NSC staff by Rumsfeld almost as a kind of experiment, because Rumsfeld is very dubious about the American occupation of Iraq, knows it's not going well, would prefer a quick exit to a lot of the nation building that's being undertaken. And he sort of inserts her as a dissident voice to see if he can push Bush out of Iraq a little earlier than Bush wants to go. And what happens in the course of this terrible, sad romance that Ross and Allison rekindle is that you see the two of them gradually shifting sides. You see Ross becoming disillusioned with Bush when he's down for an extended period in New Orleans and sees the what he views as the very inadequate response by the administration to the devastation that the hurricane has performed. And Allie, in the course of the book, much to her own surprise, because of things she sees, particularly on trips back to Iraq, where she has something to do with the war crimes trial of Saddam Hussein, she begins to move in the opposite direction. She begins to move in a more pro-Bush direction, thinking that we have to salvage something from Iraq. We've got to have an extended stay there. Something good has to come out of this. And Bush himself, in ways that I hope are plausible in the book, becomes acquainted with both of them and becomes wrapped up in their own personal problems and takes an affectionate interest in these two people who almost seem to be, you know, micro versions of his two huge macro problems, namely New Orleans and Iraq.
Right. You know, some of the portrayals are very funny. And what I love is the way, you know, we're so used to seeing Washington figures speak one way for the cameras, and you manage to capture probably the way they capture them as people. And I really enjoyed that part of the book, just that the portrayals of these people. But I do have to ask about Donald Rumsfeld, because as you mentioned, you know, Donald Rumsfeld's having sort of his own sort of moment like McNamara did in Vietnam. I mean, he's been the architect of this get-in, change the regime, and now he's sort of having second thoughts about this. And I never really thought of that of him when he was Secretary of Defense.
I don't think he certainly wasn't a dove. But if you read his memoirs and read some of the histories of the period, you realize that he was not at all opposed to getting in there. But the question of what we would do once we were there was very much, obviously, on his mind and everyone else's. And you begin to see some distance between him and Dick Cheney, who many years before had been his protege. Rumsfeld had been his boss way back in the Nixon administration, and they had been very close personally and politically for many years. And they both, Cheney and Rumsfeld, had an uneasy relationship with Condoleezza Rice. And Condi Rice is constantly frustrated by Rumsfeld, who's very gnomic and inscrutable, and she tries to read him. She tries not to be outmaneuvered by him. And a lot of that rivalry informs the book. I think one of the things that it says something about politics, I guess, that when I've written these books, I wind up making lists. Who dislikes whom in the administration? I started this with Watergate. And, you know, you can do this whole kind of daisy chain of dislike and rivalry. And it is, to a certain extent, what motivates people. You know, there's that line, it's a kind of movement slogan. It tends to be a slogan on the left. It was associated with the feminist movement for a long time, but other movements as well. The personal is political. You know, and the actions you take in your personal life, small decisions you make, all have political implications. And I've never quite liked that, because it politicizes every breath you take. And I think that that's a dangerous, bad way to live. I think to some extent we're living that way now. People are so locked into their politics that they're being bent out of shape by them. But I've often believed that it's almost the opposite. And I think what I try to do in these books is to show the opposite, that the political is personal. Namely, the personal motivations, personality quirks, the background experiences of people, all the things that make up somebody's emotional life, their private life, all of those things inevitably bleed into and to some extent motivate the political decisions that they take. They can't stop being themselves, people, when they enter politics. And so what I really hope to do in these books is just speculate, and fiction is speculation. This is not history. historical fiction is always fiction, however you may try to get a lot of the small things accurate. But to try to speculate on what might have made people do some of the things that they did. And I think when you look at politicians that way, you're likely to be more sympathetic toward them. You're likely to see them more as ordinary, non-famous citizens. I used to hope that historical fiction could in some ways bridge the political divide. I mean, I used to get a lot of mail that would say, you know, I was surprised reading your Watergate book because I always detested Nixon, or reading your Reagan book, I always detested Reagan, but I was surprised that I kind of felt for him at moments. I could see why he was doing something or so devastated by the results of something he did. And I used to think, though, that was a good function for historical fiction, if it could make people look at people on the other side of their own politics, you know, with a certain sympathy. I'd have to say I'm not that optimistic about the potential of this genre anymore. I just think at the moment, things are too calamitous. We're all too dug in, and we're living in this constant atmosphere of emergency and this constant feeling of being on the brink. And I think it's going to be a while, long while, I'm afraid, before the country relaxes again to some extent.
So we shouldn't look for a quartet of books of Republican presidents.
My friend Christopher Buckley is writing, is a very adroit, witty novelist. He read some review of Landfall about a week or so ago in one of the papers, which sort of imagined that, well, I suppose Allen will go on to the Trump administration next. And he sent me an email saying, don't you dare. He said, I'm 23,000 words in to a Trump novel. And his working title, I think, is Make Russia Great Again. I've got no desire to write about this, because I don't want to spend 3 years in the president's head. It's just not a friendly place for me. I'm much more conservative than most of my writing peers, most of my novel writing friends, but I don't see him as the kind of character with complexities. As I say, all these different sides of George W. Bush, I don't see him as the kind of character that's that I would be able to inhabit. So I'm going to just try to endure this administration, not chronicle it.
Thomas Mallon, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thomas Mallon's latest book is titled Landfall. It's published by Pantheon Books. You'll be talking about the book tonight in an event sponsored by Booksmart Tulsa tonight at 7 at Magic City Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.